Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. We are deja vu all over again. Here we are. Dust off your reflexes from 2020, but also, let's everyone please take a chill pill. Vaccines work almost all the time. And those who do get Delta aren't getting very sick, aren't flooding hospitals, aren't collapsing the healthcare system, and aren't dying. Data from Singapore has come out recently. They've been fighting Delta for about 6 months. What they have found is that in the vaccinated people, and they have a variety of vaccines there in Singapore, about 90% of the cases they identify are completely asymptomatic. This other is from the UK, and I have some comments about that in a moment, but the risk of getting Delta, which the UK has been suffering with, if exposed, are pretty low. The AstraZeneca vaccine, I want to remind you, that's not the vaccine that's approved in the United States. It was less effective. It's still 79% protective against infection, 88% protective against symptoms, and 96% effective against hospitalizations. And Pfizer and Moderna mRNA vaccines are actually a bit better than that. What's up with this issue of Delta being so much more contagious? And what's up with the vaccines? Well, I want to rewind for just a moment and remind you that how vaccines work is they make us make a type of antibody called IgG. IgG, I think of that as blood and lymph. So it's the antibody that circulates through your lymph tissues, through your blood. There are other types of antibody. There's IgE, also in your blood, but also in your nose. That's the one that makes you have allergies. And there's IgA, and IgA is the one that is in your nose. So the vaccines cause us to make IgG, but not very much IgA. Since the vaccine doesn't trigger this, we have a lot of asymptomatic nasal carriage, and because Delta makes more volumes, even people who are vaccinated have potentially infectious levels of virus, detectable levels at the thresholds that were set for what we thought was the infectious level. So it may not be more infectious per se, it just may be more particles per unit snot or per unit sneeze, and therefore not changed in a fundamental way, but just a matter of, you know, spam, right? Delta is good at spamming, and it's spamming everybody. Last month, around the middle of July, England lifted all restrictions, and it was in the middle of a Delta surge. Everyone predicted that there would be a big spike, and something totally unexpected happened. The cases began going down. What was up with that? Well, in the United Kingdom, July coincides with the middle of a soccer tournament, and in an international soccer tournament. And so in England, the drop in cases started going down about 5 days after, 5 days after the British got kicked out of the competition, which meant people stopped going to pubs and having a drink and cheering and talking about the wonderful game and arguing and doing all the things that you do at a sports bar. So it's probably a total coincidence, but the drop is totally counterintuitive. I'm calling this the sports bar effect. And I think it demonstrates quite clearly how not to be exposed to COVID. And particularly if you are choosing not to vaccinate, you need to watch your exposure because it's pretty clear that this thing is making unvaccinated people pretty sick. So I also wanted to talk about masks, but first I want to talk about home testing. I've asked a lot of my patients, and many people don't know this, you can buy consumer tests. They take about 15 minutes, actually. Honestly, they take about 5 minutes. They're very similar to the strep throat tests that you've probably had in your doctor's office. They're very similar to the pregnancy tests. It's an antibody test, and they've set the threshold of this for infectiousness. And so it's going to pick up people who are shedding enough virus to be infectious. that is still true, even when dealing with one of these variants. You can get two tests in a box for $20, and it's extremely convenient. I've started testing myself basically every morning when I hit the office if I'm going to be seeing patients. You know, knock wood, so far so good. But my point is, this rapid testing might be just the thing that you want if you have older relatives or family members who are vulnerable. Perhaps you have someone who's on cancer chemotherapy or someone who's immunosuppressed because of an organ transplant or an autoimmune disease. Those individuals are still at risk, even if they're fully vaccinated. We're now really contemplating giving those individuals a third shot because research has come out. The third shot's the charm. Because their immune system is suppressed, it doesn't quite get the message from the two shots. But after the third shot, we see a vigorous antibody response and, predictably, the kind of immunity that we want the entire population to have, which is to say, COVID becomes an inconvenience, and that's all it is. So, boosters. Germany's talking about doing boosters. That's not happening here in the United States. The difference between a booster and vaccinating the autoimmune disease people and the immunosuppressed is that this isn't a booster for them. For them, they're on a different vaccine schedule. So instead of two shots, it takes three. It's not a booster. Do we need to boost the general population? And if so, when? Well, clearly, so far, we don't. When we talk about boosters, also realize that we really don't have much data about boosting in terms of whether we could use or mix different vaccines. So if boosters come along, let's get the same vaccine you've had. Make sure you know what you've had, and that's super important. We're back in masks, and I think the best way to think about the masks is for people who are not walking into a hospital room of someone with COVID, you want to think of yourself as potentially one of those asymptomatic carriers. That's why you're wearing a mask when you're inside, when you're around a bunch of people outside, maybe. If you're not eating, and if you are eating, maybe you do want to social distance a bit. Even if you haven't done a test, if you're going to go out to family barbecue and you want to do a sing-along, you probably want to use one of these rapid tests before you leave for the park. And that's what I'm saying. These things are actually underutilized. They're not being advertised, and I don't think they're being used as well as they could be. Some short news items first, and later on we'll have a science lesson about blood pressure and the other ACE receptor, which, of course, has gotten bumped out of the news. Our first story, postmenopausal women can dance their way to better health. Yes, you should be dancing. Yeah. Women often struggle with managing their weight and other health risk factors like high cholesterol as they go through menopause. A new study suggests that dancing may effectively lower cholesterol levels, improve fitness, body composition, and, in the process, self-esteem. This was published in the Journal of the American Menopause Society, which is named, surprisingly, Menopause. Now, many of the effects of dancing have been shown to benefit just about everything that increases in terms of threat level after menopause. Dancing generally is very good for the bones. It's also very good for the sense of balance and for your coordination, so fewer falls. It's stronger bones. That all sounds good. Plus, strengthening exercises. Dancing is very good. It both strengthens and is aerobic, so you get cardiovascular strengthening as well as general axial muscle strengthening. Almost every form of dancing improves the core musculature, which is super important for reducing back pain. In the study that was published, women were given a 3 times weekly dance regimen, and they were monitored for functional fitness, their lipid profile, their hemoglobin A1C, an indicator of average blood sugar, and also self-esteem. Now, the reason I wanted to lead with this article is that I have a friend who I watched pre-menopause, but she began to dance maybe 5 years before she went through menopause. She was quite overweight, And she loved the dancing. It was a form of belly dancing that's very covered up. It's a sort of Middle Eastern, not, you know, tourist belly dancing. And she loved it. Her back pain went away. Her neck pain went away. Her knee pain went away. She lost weight. She made new friends. Her mood improved. Her focus improved. This is someone that I know quite well. It's anecdotal, of course, but dance therapy is great. It's generally low cost and it's low risk of injury. The improvements are substantial. I just think that if you keep dancing, you are giving yourself a much better chance of aging well. I have to talk about my friend's Aunt Edie, who passed away recently. And my friend showed me a video that she found when she was going through things. And it's a picture of this lovely 90-year-old woman dancing, holding her skirt up, swaying back and forth to the music. It is such a beautiful, joyful picture. And I think we all stand to get out and do some dancing, whether we're menopausal, premenopausal, postmenopausal, or even if we are male. Let's get out there and do some dancing this weekend, okay? Another feminist story that I wanted to share with you is on a much sadder note. Nearly half of female surgeons experienced major pregnancy complications. This is a very surprising number, 48%. The researchers surveyed 1,175 surgeons and surgical trainees from across the United States. They asked them about their or their partner's pregnancy experience. 48% of surveyed surgeons experienced major pregnancy complications. If they were women who operated 12 or more hours per week during the last trimester, they had a much higher rate. Women now comprise 38% of surgical residents. About one in five practicing surgeons in the United States is female. We continue to be a growing proportion, but still a minority. Unfortunately, the culture of surgery is very brutal to female trainees. Many trainees choose to delay pregnancy until after the age of 35. That would be people who are finishing up their training. That's about when you get done. Of course, that increases the risk for pregnancy complications. And many surgeons operate many, many hours per week on their feet, standing in an operating table, high risk. So it turns out that the magic number is 12 hours. If a woman during the last trimester of pregnancy operates 12 or more hours, she has a much higher risk of complications. Over half of female surgeons worked more than 60 hours per week during pregnancy. 42% of women who experienced a miscarriage. That means that the miscarriage rate compared to the general population of women surgeons is twice the normal rate. Many of those women took no days off work. They went back to work the day after their miscarriage. That 12 hours a week, we need to institutionalize that to protect these pregnancies. Let's see, some of the other odds here. We need to do something about this. Female surgeons had a 1.7 times greater odds of major pregnancy complications, much more back pain, many more emergency C-sections, much more postpartum depression. About 11% of the female surgeons experienced postpartum depression. You know, as I was thinking about this, I was reminded of the data about African American women's pregnancies and the fact that African American women's pregnancies have much higher complication rates. If you look at women in Africa and you normalize for access to medical care, what you find is that they don't have higher miscarriage rates or higher pregnancy complication rates. And I think about that concept that I've recently heard about weathering in African Americans, the sort of constant low-grade stress over one's entire life. And I think about surgeons and the intermittent high-grade stress that surgeons experience. And I think as a group, they're more weathered by the demands of that lifestyle. as I said, it's a very macho culture. It's hard to ask for help. It's hard, particularly if it's frowned upon or otherwise retaliated against. I want to reach out to everyone and say, if you know a woman surgeon, send her some flowers, because those ladies work very, very hard. So do the male surgeons. Everybody works hard. But I think that for women, it's a bit harder because they have still got something to prove, how tough they are. And maybe that's not great when you're pregnant. Our next story is, oh, just weird, okay? It's a reversible male contraceptive. Of course, men have condoms and men have vasectomies. Vasectomies are difficult to reverse and often unsuccessfully reversed. Researchers working in mice have developed magnetic biodegradable nanomaterials that reduce the likelihood of mice fathering pups. It's kind of a crazy technology. Let's start with male infertility, right? So elevated temperatures, we know that that impairs sperm production. That's, in fact, why the testicles are located in such a vulnerable place, is they need air cooling. When men come in with a low sperm count, one of the things you tell them is boxer shorts, stay out of hot tubs. Some researchers thought, well, maybe we could cause more intense heating and discourage sperm. So most of the nanomaterials that have been attempted by injecting into the testicles have not been biodegradable. But now researchers have come up with a magnet thermal approach that doesn't need to be injected directly into the testes, so getting around the pain. They used iron oxide nanoparticles, which are biodegradable and can be guided and heated with magnetic fields. So basically, the researchers injected into the bloodstreams of mice citric acid-coated nanoparticles, these iron oxide particles, and then used magnets to pull the iron particles towards the testes. So I guess we're talking little magnetic jock straps on the mice, and it's kind of a crazy idea. Then, once they'd gotten the nanomaterials localized to the testes, they applied an alternating magnetic field to the area for 15 minutes that heated the testicles to a temperature of 104, which shrank them down a little bit and inhibited spermatogenesis for about 30 to 60 days after the treatment. The mice couldn't father any pups, but by day 60, they were back, so it's reversible. I'm trying to imagine how you scale this for humans, and it's just weird and crazy, but I thought you'd be amused, so hopefully I'm correct. It's time to break for an email or two. I'm going to start with one from Anonymous in Ontario that we didn't get to last week. Hi, Dr. Dawn. I absolutely love your program. Thank you for all you do. I'm writing about a sore left leg pain. The pain is worse at the end of the day and worsens after sitting. Started a few weeks ago, and the pain moves around from ankle to calf and to the back of the thigh. I saw a physician's assistant, and she ordered an ultrasound. A DVT, that's to see a deep venous thrombosis, was ruled out. But another type of ultrasound has been ordered, a Doppler ultrasound. I have to wait a few weeks for this imaging. Is this to rule out peripheral artery disease or varicose veins? I'm 46, in good health, and eat a plant-heavy diet, not on any medications. So the Doppler ultrasound primarily is used for looking at arterial blood flow, so peripheral artery disease. Finishing up the email, Anonymous writes, the pain is quite bad at night and wakes me up some night. Would there be other labs or blood tests that would be helpful to investigate this while I wait for imaging? I want to just say, Anonymous, that peripheral artery disease just doesn't usually hit at night. The fact that you mention the location here, this really sounds like maybe the L4 dermatome. So I want you to go into a browser and search for L4 dermatome, D-E-R-M-A-T-O-M-E. And you'll see some maps, kind of like humans with zebra stripes. And you'll look for the one for L4. And I want you to match whether the pain pattern matches the stripe on the image, because it sort of sounds like it might be L4. The fact that the pain is worse when sitting and gets worse at the end of the day, that would be very characteristic of a pinched nerve. And there's basically two places it could be pinched. And one place is at the spinal level, where the L4 comes out between the vertebrae. The other place is actually in the butt. There's a deep muscle called the piriformis, and your sciatic nerve is composed of a bunch of these nerve roots, L4, L5, S1, and these are woven together, kind of like cabling, and they pass between two fingers of muscle. If it's piriformis syndrome, you might be able to confirm it by just doing a simple test. I'm going to try to describe it, but if you just go to YouTube and look for piriformis test, you'll find lots of indicators of that. And so I want to encourage you to go there and do that. Let's do one more quick email before the break. And this is a regular emailer, Shaul in Israel. Shaul writes, I would like to hear your opinion about Dr. Andrew Huberman. Can I trust his ideas and his podcast? Well, Shaul, I didn't do an exhaustive check on Dr. Huberman. I did go to his website, which is HubermanLab.com, and I looked at his bona fides, as they say. He looks very legitimate. He has good credentials. He's involved in neurology at Stanford, which is, you know, pretty straight-up institution. We're very proud of that here in Northern California. Also, I looked at one of his podcasts, and I didn't listen to the whole thing, but there were about three things that really legitimized his website for me. First of all, no ads. He wasn't selling anything. Maybe there's some financial support on the podcast itself. I didn't find that. I just kind of bounced around and looked at the description of several of the podcasts. The science sounded good, but what also really impressed me was he posted actual references in the medical literature, which were genuine about his topics. I can't speak for his opinions because I haven't done an exhaustive search on him. And opinions, of course, are those of the speaker, but he is speaking from a position that is legitimate and not crazy. And the fact that he's, you know, at least stating, I didn't go and check to make sure he was still at Stanford, but assuming that that's true, you could go and find him and confirm that. And if it's true, then I think you can at least consider his opinions to be legitimate, whether they're right or not. Well, that's science for you. A lot of things we aren't entirely sure of for a very, very long time, as I think the changing landscape on our favorite global pandemic illustrates. So our next email from Frank in Pacific Grove. Frank writes, Hi, I'm a former patient of yours. I originally came to see you for asthma because I was having adverse reactions to conventional treatments such as steroids and inhalers. Your tests revealed I had an elevated CRP and multiple food allergies. It's safe to say you've never seen a worse food allergy test result. Otherwise, my test results were good. My question is, do you think it's safe for me to get the COVID vaccine, either Pfizer or Moderna, due to the possibility of added preservatives and food substances in the ingredients? I've already ruled out Johnson & Johnson. So first of all, I want to say what's in the Pfizer vaccine. There's really not a lot of stuff, although it's the polysyllabic kind of chemical names that are very, very, how should we put this, extremely intimidating just because of the terminology. Let's talk about what's in there. Of course, there's messenger RNA, and there are lipids, that is to say fats, because the vaccine, the messenger RNA, is encapsulated in a fat globule. And part of that fat globule is a detergent-like compound called polyethylene glycol. This is an emulsifier in ice cream, for example. It is a very common in food products, in cosmetics. So the chances are, if you were allergic to it, you would know it. The Pfizer doesn't contain any preservatives. It doesn't contain latex, and it doesn't contain eggs. So many of the typical antigenic things that we would worry about just aren't there. and it doesn't contain polysorbate, which is probably the thing you're worried about from the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Did a little literature search, and I found a letter in the Annals of Allergy about polyethylene glycol in the allergies in the Pfizer BioNTech. And what they had done is they were looking at people who had or appeared to have an immediate allergic reaction to the Pfizer vaccine. They came up with a rate of anaphylaxis. This one's an old statistic, but back in January, so this would have been an extrapolation, it was about 2.5 cases of allergic reaction per million doses. So they proposed that maybe it was the polyethylene glycol as a possible culprit. It turns out that polyethylene glycol you can find right in your drugstore and maybe even in your supermarket. It's sold under the name of Miralax as a laxative. A slow-acting laxative takes a few days to get rolling, but it's one of the few laxatives that you can take long-term. Now, I always start off with water and magnesium because usually that does the trick. But if for whatever reason that's not feasible, I use Miralax in some of my patients, particularly those with severe mobility issues, because it doesn't usually overshoot. And if you're having trouble moving around, there's nothing like a laxative overshoot to ruin your day. So they used Miralax. They did skin testing. This was at three different Mayo Clinic sites. And they took people who had had a reaction of some kind to the Pfizer shots. They all tested negative on skin testing. That's reassuring. I want to read what the reactions were for the Pfizer vaccine. Urticaria, that's to say a hive. And if it was a hive locally, that could be from trauma. If it was generalized, then you have to consider that there was an allergic reaction in that person. Runny nose and rapid heartbeat, probably not a drug allergy. Facial flushing, maybe not. Throat fullness and itching, yep. Throat tightness, yeah. If it affects the throat, I tend to believe it. So essentially, what they found was that it looks very unlikely. It's extremely unlikely that you're going to have an allergic reaction here, even though you have food allergies. And if you don't have a significant reaction to ice cream, or you've used Miralax in the past, then I would say go forward with the Pfizer or the Moderna vaccine. People who have asthma, of course, are at very high risk if they contract COVID of ending up in the hospital. So I can't emphasize enough that the risk-benefit ratio for you really favors that. If you were to have an allergic reaction, all of the vaccine centers are perfectly well-equipped to deal with it, and it's extremely unlikely. So after 60 years, scientists have finally figured out how our body controls blood pressure, or rather, they have found the blood pressure meter, the barometer that's inside cells. And not surprising, it's in the kidney, and it's in the cells called renin cells. We're going to talk about the actual science in a moment, but you're going to need some background. First of all, most of you have probably driven a car at one time or another with cruise control. Phenomenologically, if the car has cruise control, it really has two levels of control, right? It has the driver and it has the cruise control. And what you'll see with an automated cruise control, like the sophisticated automatic cruise control in a Tesla, you push a button to set the speed, and if the car is heading up a hill, it will tend to accelerate or, you know, goose the throttle in order to keep that speed up. And if the car is heading downhill, it'll hit the brakes to slow down because it's basically trying to maintain that speed that you've set. And of course, if circumstances change, like someone jumps from the slow lane and directly in front of you, which happens reliably to me at least two or three times a day when I drive to work, well, then your brain cruise control is going to slow down by hitting the brakes yourself manually, which is why distracted driving while you've got cruise control on is a bad idea. Well, it's a bad idea under any circumstances. That's what we call a feedback loop, right? The car has a speedometer. It tells it how fast it's going. You have eyeballs. That tells you that you're approaching an object. Both of these things result in a change in behavior that changes the speed. In the case of a chemical reaction, it may change what's happening. So now we're going to talk with that perspective on blood pressure and the kidney. So the baroreceptors in the kidney are a mechanotransducer. In other words, they experience stretch. It detects pressure changes outside the cell. It transmits this mechanical signal literally via a network of tiny fibrils, the cytoskeleton. It goes into the nucleus, and the cytoskeleton movement actually turns on DNA, similar to how our ear bones, so the transduce sound, so that little tiny vibrations of our eardrum are reduced even further so that you don't rip your ear open when there's a big noise. The nerve cells that are sitting in that cochlea, which is our inner ear, turn into electrical signals, and that's how our brain can understand sound. Well, there's no brain here. The brain is the nucleus of the kidney cells. You can decrease activity of the renin gene, which is named, nomically enough, REN1. If you push on the cells in lab dishes, you'll actually turn down the production of messenger RNA. You'll turn down the activity of the renin gene. This is the first level of the feedback loop that is happening in control of our blood pressure. So what exactly does renin do? Well, renin's an enzyme. It breaks down a protein that's floating around in the blood that is doing absolutely nothing but waiting to be cleaved and activated by renin. So renin's basically one of those little molecular scissors. And this inert protein called angiotensinogen, and ogen is one of those medical shorthands. It means something that can be activated in the bloodstream but isn't activated in its normal state. It turns it into something called angiotensin 1. Then the angiotensin 1 floats around in the bloodstream, and it comes across receptors on the inside of the blood vessels that are called ACE, angiotensin converting enzyme. This is the type 1 ACE, and it turns it into angiotensin 2. So you've got two places here where you can modulate the response. There's more, actually, when you're talking about blood pressure. But the angiotensin 2 is now going to cause the blood vessels to tighten up, angiotensing up, right? Angiotensin. And this is super important to how your blood pressure works in the body. There's also neurological control of blood pressure, both to the kidneys and to the blood vessels themselves directly, and also neurological control based on the adrenal gland and the release of adrenaline or epinephrine. So multiple feedback loops. And in general, these chemical signals are very, very short-lived, and they're just around for a few seconds, and then they're broken down again. So they send a signal, and then they send a signal again, and then they send a signal again. And that's how the feedback loops work. Why am I talking about this? Well, because I said there's two kinds of angiotensin-converting enzyme, right? So the first one makes the angiotensin 2. The second one breaks it down. And that second one is called angiotensin-converting enzyme type 2. And that is the target for the COVID virus. That's how the COVID virus gets into the cell, is by hooking onto this. And as it hooks onto it, it disables the enzyme piece of this. And what is the ACE2 doing? What is the angiotensin converting enzyme doing? It's actually turning angiotensin into a bunch of other types. So numeral 1 through numeral 7. And these act in a feedback loop on the immune system. So they open up the blood vessels, so they lower blood pressure, and they're anti-inflammatory, and they're antioxidative, and they're anti-proliferative. So the ACE and the ACE2 activity are in dynamic balance. And it's a very delicate teeter-totter type balance. So if you step on the teeter-totter on one side with the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein, you've thrown off one of the more important anti-inflammatory mechanisms in the body. And it's also antithrombotic. So a lot of what we see in COVID is directly due to the damage to the angiotensin-converting enzyme 2 receptor. Now, we treat people's blood pressure and this angiotensin system, renin angiotensin system, it's called. We treat that with several drugs that you may be familiar with. Enalapril, captopril, the chemical name ends in PRIL. These are angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors. So they prevent angiotensin-converting enzyme from making angiotensin 1, so it doesn't get converted, so the blood pressure doesn't eventually go up. So the angiotensin-converting enzyme is converting angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2. Excuse me, I misspoke right then. But the point is, we also have receptor blockers. The angiotensin receptor protein can be blocked, and those are called ARB, and those are the sartans. So you've got losartan, you've got all of these other artan drugs, and they work in a way that makes them actually protective against lung damage to COVID. This has been demonstrated in animal studies. If you block the receptor, then you prevent the spike protein from being able to damage it. And so therefore, you keep your anti-inflammatory functioning. This has been shown. They have taken telmisartan, which is, this was done in humans in Argentina. They gave basically high doses of telmisartan to people who, within 4 days of developing symptomatic COVID, and they showed an important reduction in ICU admission and a shortening of the time to discharge. So remember, this is a hospital study. It did not have a placebo control. So it's possible that it does need to be reproduced. But in animal studies, they've actually aerosolized ACE2, given recombinant DNA, basically recombinant ACE2, manufactured it, and given it via a nebulizer to animals who have been infected with COVID and shown a protective effect. So we've got here some really interesting evidence that a drug that is FDA approved and cheap and pretty safe, you know, the big side effect from this is going to be fluctuations in blood pressure, and possibly you'll have to watch people's potassium levels because you have to give twice the usual maximum dose and you have to give it twice daily. So you wouldn't want to do this to an outpatient. But for inpatient medicine, that's quite manageable because you can monitor the blood. I'm thinking that this may prove to be an important benefit in people who are suffering. And I love that it's cheap, you know. So maybe move over ivermectin and welcome telmisartan to the mix. All right, checking our time. I want to pre-promote next week's science dive. Next week, we're going to lead with marijuana and the brain and a lot of interesting research and information about seizure disorders and the endocannabinoids, that's the natural cannabinoids, and how they may be highly protective for the brain and how we might be able to manipulate them with readily available, inexpensive, non-intoxicating substances that don't affect memory. So come back next week to Ask Dr. Dawn for that. Meanwhile, we're going to wrap up with a few stories. This one is about multiple sclerosis. This was a University of California Irvine study. They found that a certain protein was activated in multiple sclerosis and that you could manipulate the T regulatory cells. These are the ones that turn down autoimmune disease. It illuminated the role of a protein called piezo-1, which is a little tunnel-shaped protein that's found, called an ion channel, that's found in the cell wall of these T cells. PISA-1 is actually kind of a bad actor because it reduces T cell functioning. So, as usual, if they want to study something, you make transgenic mice that don't make it and see how they work. Well, what they found was if you took it out of the system, these mice were resistant to inflammation that was triggered to create a mouse model of multiple sclerosis. So basically, it was harder to give these mice multiple sclerosis, even though we know how to do that. The protein that was missing essentially turned out to be protective. So T cells use these compounds, proteins, and ion channels to regulate themselves. But too much T cell activity causes autoimmune disorder. And so you have a second type of cells called the T regulatory cells, which kind of act to restrain the immune system. If we can block PISA-1, we should be able to create a drug that would be very helpful in kind of across the board for autoimmune disease. And PISA-1 is really not essential to everything else that the T cells do, like interstitial motility, activation, proliferation, differentiation. All of the other T cell functions were not affected by taking PISA-1 out. So that means it's a good target because it only decreases Tregs. So if you inhibit it, again, you'll be getting more regulatory cells and you can therefore have a better chance of turning down autoimmune disease. We should be able to be nuanced about this and dial it down but not turn it off. And that's the problem with many of our autoimmune drugs, is that we end up not just dialing it down but turning it off, leading to immunosuppression, which of course makes you more vulnerable to infections. Thing we were just talking about, referencing the COVID vaccine. So while we're on the subject of infections, many people, unfortunately, suffer from illnesses that cause them to be dependent on ventilators. Often these are neurological illnesses where the ability to breathe is impaired due to spinal cord injury or even autoimmune disease, such as Guillain-Barré syndrome. You really can't leave an endotracheal tube in a person for more than about 10 days. At that point, you have to take it out of their mouth and you have to create a little hole in the trachea and put a tube in there. And that will last for a long time, but you get infection and you get a change, a substantial change in the microbiome. And part of what the healthy bacteria are doing in the upper airway microbiome is keeping inflammation down. So when we intubate them, recurrent bacterial colonization with bad bacteria, the microbiome alters, it's no longer anti-inflammatory, you get scarring and stenosis, as well as increased infections. You don't want to treat this with antibiotics. So the investigators are playing around with something called antimicrobial peptides, which are very small proteins that destabilize bacterial membranes, but they do it across the board, rather like silver and copper do. They're so injurious to the surface of bacteria that the bacteria don't really have a chance to develop immunity. It's just like, you know, a flamethrower, effectively. It's hard to be immune from. You don't have time to mutate. So they created a polymer coating. It's called lasioglossin, and it has broad antibacterial activity against the bad bacteria, but does not impair the human microbiome bacteria that are ordinarily found there. So it's selective. And I'm sure they had to mess around with molecules for quite some time to get that to work. But it's extremely exciting to think that that complication can be avoided, and that will prolong the lives of people and improve their quality of life. Because every time you hit them with antibiotics, you're messing up their microbiome and increasing all of the problems with the gut that go with that. More short stories about scientific advances. This one about glucagon. Glucagon is the yin to insulin's yang, okay? It's a hormone that's released. It raises blood sugar levels just in the same way that insulin lowers blood sugar levels. And at the moment, we have glucagon in bottles, but it has to be given by injection when a person overdoses accidentally on their insulin. There's also a class of type 1 diabetics called brittle diabetics. And for children with type 1 diabetes, this is an extremely challenging problem because a severe hypoglycemic episode every time you get a really low blood sugar, the child can have a seizure, the child can sustain brain damage, and over multiple times, you know, you could see how terrified the parents would be. And unfortunately, when a child goes through overnight, if they are asleep, they don't get any symptoms, and it's very hard. How are you going to, you know, poke your child and check their blood sugar? A parent can check their blood sugars, their children's glucose levels right before they go to bed, and they'll be fine. And then at 2 a.m., their blood sugar is low. And that's because the injectable insulin that type 1 diabetics need isn't always reliably absorbed in the same way. It's been a problem. Children being rushed to the hospital in the middle of the night, parents being so afraid that they're waking the kids up multiple times a night to check their blood sugar levels. The researchers were trying to develop hydrogels that would basically only disintegrate and release glucagon if the glucose levels dropped. Otherwise, they would stay, the glucagon, this active hormone that raises blood sugar, would stay locked in the gel. They found a hydrogel, which is kind of a goo, very similar to that hydrogel that you grow plants in, if you've seen that, or the, it's actually not that far off from the stuff that you use in diapers, actually. That's also kind of a form of hydrogel when it's liquefied. So if you can imagine that goo, it's a mesh. When you look at the microstructure, it looks like a bunch of spaghetti noodles, and they've sprinkled little bits of glucagon in. When the glucose levels drop in the bloodstream, the hydrogel, basically the spaghetti noodles, denature and they drop away from the glucagon, and the glucagon can get out of the tangle of little spaghetti fibers and get into the bloodstream. So ideally, this would be given every night along with the nighttime insulin. It would be administered, and 3 or 4 hours later, if the child had a problem, the glucagon would be released and it would save the child from a severe episode. So this is still a concept, but for anyone who's ever had a child with diabetes, I can assure you this sounds like a really, really good idea. And I can remember some brittle diabetics I've taken care of in my life where I truly feared for these children's brain functions. I'm really happy to be presenting to you all of these new technologies, all of this stuff that we are learning every day, and encouraging you to support government financing of science. We really need to have science free and unencumbered, and furthermore, not patenting everything and focusing on drug development when we should be focusing on human progress. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.